What's up, everybody? I'm Paige.
And I'm Chris.
And this is Animates. Today we're going to be discussing the 1998 Nickelodeon series, The Wild Thornberries.
The Wild Thornberries, as you all might remember, was a Klasky Supo show, meaning you'll probably recognize it from the distinctive art style associated with that studio's projects like Rugrats, Real Monsters, as Paige and I have just recently remembered, as told by Ginger. So pretty powerhouse of a studio. I would argue that The Wild Thornberries was probably their second most popular show after Rugrats. I mean, God, you can't beat Rugrats. It was the beginning of Nicktoons.
It was literally a juggernaut, yeah. So this was the third program that Klasky Supo made in partnership with Nickelodeon, following Real Monsters and Rugrats. It was created by, you know, the titular Klasky and Supo, as well as Steve Pepoon, David Silverman, and Steven Starsick. Interestingly, you may all remember the urban legend about Regular Show, that it was actually pitched to Adult Swim and they didn't take it, so they retooled it and put it on Cartoon Network or whatever, which we revealed is not true. That's not the case. That never happened. However, this show actually was pitched to Fox as an adult animated sitcom, and they turned it down. So they did then retool it as a family-friendly series for Nickelodeon, and they renamed Eliza, they renamed the youngest daughter, and they refocused the show around her instead of being more of like an ensemble thing. However, notably, they had received feedback that their other shows just didn't really show parents or showed parents in kind of a negative light. So they intentionally made this show more focused on parents. And if they were intending to show these parents in like a positive light, I think they may have had some oversights, which we will get to.
Yeah. Listen, what's negative about Stu making pudding at 4 o'clock in the morning and saying that
he's lost control of his life?
Like, I think that that is a very realistic portrayal of an adult, and you know, and it's funny, and adults can. I get what they're saying, because I guess if you think about Rugrats, it's like Angelica's parents are kind of meh, and her mom is kind of the worst, and I don't know. I feel like Tommy's parents are good. But
yeah, no, and like when we talked about that show, we talked about how we thought that, like, aside from Angelica's parents, for the most part, all of the parents in that show are good parents, and they also work together to like raise their kids and everything. And like, if the issue is like it does definitely show the parents and interacting with one another, and like if the issue was that like it wasn't showing the parents interacting with the kids as much, I don't feel like that's fair because they're babies. Like, you can't have a conversation with a baby who can't speak, you know?
Yeah, and at the same time, it's so funny because, as we'll talk about, I don't feel like the Thornberries interact with their children all that much.
Yeah, I don't feel like... I feel like there are some issues with the Thornberry parenting, and I would like to discuss that. We can definitely get there. But just a little bit more background... So the characters and voice actors, it's interesting because there's a real mix between like very famous people and people that you have never heard of in your life. The main character is Eliza Thornberry, who is a 12-year-old girl. She was voiced by a person named Lacey Chabert, who was apparently Bianca from All My Children. So I know who that is, because my mom watched All My Children at that time.
We were a General Hospital family.
Yes, we have actually discussed this in the past. She's the youngest member of the family. She can magically talk to animals, and she's besties with the family's pet chimpanzee. Also worth discussing, pet chimpanzee. His name is Darwin. He wears clothes, and he's voiced by Tom Kane, who we have encountered in other shows before. Not a ton. I mean, he's most well known for voice work in like Star Wars properties, and in video games. But he has been in like he's been in other shows. He was in Foster's Home for Imaginary Friends. He was Mr. Harriman, where he was also doing a very posh British voice, though in a different tone. And Darwin is a very anxious. An anxious young chimpanzee. Eliza has an older sister. Her name is Debbie. She was voiced by Danielle Harris, who is kind of a scream queen. She's been in a bunch of Halloween movies. And she's 16, and she's like a grunge-style teen. And in many ways, she's a very stereotypical teen. And they have two parents. So their father, Sir Nigel Archibald Thornberry, KBE. I really love that the Wikipedia knows exactly what, like, level of, like, knighthood he has attained in the most excellent order of the British Empire. Who is like a David Attenborough type, and he's voiced by Tim Curry, doing an incredible job.
Tim Curry is an amazing voice actor.
Yeah, no, he does amazing. Like, if you remember anything about this show, it's probably all of Nigel's like weird noises.
Smashing!
And his super nasal voice, and Tim Curry just does an absolutely incredible job with Nigel, who is like, he's a David Attenborough type guy, like, but like crossed with like, you know, like a Steve Irwin or a Jeff Corwin, in that he actually goes out into nature, right? And which David Attenborough doesn't do that often. He normally narrates after the fact, right? But, and he's like, he's just goofy and enthusiastic about things. And his wife, Marianne, who is American, and she's voiced by Jodi Carlisle, who, like, this is what she's best known as. She's been on the small and large screen and video games and on the stage. Like, she's done a lot of stuff, but she's kind of like a journeyman actress. And she, like, she is a cinematographer. She films the show. And she's a little bit more, like, a little bit more even keel, a little bit more sardonic, you know? And a little bit more, like, grounded than Nigel. When Nigel tends to be goofy and either be, like, oblivious to things or, like, sort of intentionally, you know, view things, in the most fantastical possible way to like be funny. It's not totally clear which Nigel's one he's doing.
Nigel's got kind of that like manic pixie genius guy thing going on. Not an archetype, but I'm making it right now, which is like a person with an intellect that floats above it all. And
he just like, they'll point something out to him and he'll be like, oh my God. And he'll like interpret it in this like sort of like fantastical way. And to me, I've never been able to decide whether he's just completely oblivious and lacks common sense, even though he's a genius, or if he's doing it on purpose because he's just such like an optimistic and goofy guy that he's trying to make everyone laugh, you know?
Yeah, it's hard to know. And you do have to wonder, like, there is that sort of feeling that, like, Marianne is having to take care of him, kind of like a mom. She basically kind of has to, like, keep the household from falling apart because he certainly won't do it. Yeah. Not because he's a bad person, but he kind of lives or acts as if he's got this like charmed life.
He's kind of away with the fairies, and it seems like he is actually, he does have a charmed life, because they don't show us this, I think, until like much later in the series. I don't think either of us made it there, but like, he is an aristocrat. Like, he like, you know, was born to an aristocratic couple. He went to a famous, what's called a public school in England. It means something totally different than what a public school means here. It's a school for rich people, like Eton, right? He went to a school that is, he went to the Harrow School, which has existed since 1572, right? So he does kind of have a charmed life. Like, he's an aristocrat. Like, he grew up in a, like, a very, like, wealthy environment.
And he loves kippers.
He does. He does love kippers, which is horrifying. But then the final member of the Thornberry family is youngest son, Donnie, voiced by Flea. Paige, you say. Flea? Surely, this is a different person. You don't mean the bassist of Red Hot Chili Peppers, known for playing totally naked with just a sock on his dick, right, in this children's program? Surely you do not mean that Flea. No, I do. I do mean that Flea. That like is voiced by that Flea, and he mostly speaks in gibberish because he is a feral child that the Thornberrys found in Borneo.
Yeah, he's raised by orangutans, which is very funny because orangutans, out of all of the great apes, are the least social and most aggressive of outsiders. So I don't know why they decided to choose orangutans instead of even a gorilla would have been a better choice.
I think, well, they already said, like, in a very early episode, like the second or third episode, that they found him in Borneo. And, like, orangutans are the great apes that they have in Borneo. They don't have gorillas or chimps there.
Sure, but they could have, I guess what I'm saying is they could have, why would it have mattered if they had chosen Borneo versus the Congo or somewhere else?
Well, what I mean is I think that they said Borneo already when they hadn't thought about that. And that they felt compelled to, like, keep that consistent instead of, like, retconning it. And so then they were like, it's got to be orangutans.
Fair enough.
But I actually have some concerns about Donnie as a feral child. And I actually wanted to get Chris's opinion.
Yeah, totally. Well, okay, so let's also, I feel like I have to, before we move on, because sometimes I feel like we shortchange composers. The music of the show is very good, and I feel like it's nice because it is very, like, you know, in that sort of weirdly, like, slightly offensive way, it's, what's that genre of music called? World music,
yeah. Like, I've always hated that. I'm like, all music is world music. We don't extraterrestrial music. Like, all music is made in the world.
Just it's wild that record companies in the United States decided that every genre of music that is not European pop inspired or, like, somehow connected to the European or like the mainstream European or American diaspora is world music.
There's, like, an episode of The Flight of the Conchords where, like, their manager gets them a gig at World Music Night, and they don't know until they get there, and Jermaine's like, we don't play world music. And their manager's like, oh, New Zealand's part of the world, isn't it?
But the music is great, and the composer, Drew Newman, does a really good job of integrating a lot of different instruments and styles that, like, tie somewhat to the regions that they're currently.
It gives you, like, a sense of place. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And the composer was also the same composer of The Grim Adventures of Billy and Mandy. So, what a weird.
That's funny. That is weird. Yeah.
Yeah.
so, yeah. The basic premise of this show if you don't remember, is that Nigel Thornberry hosts a, like, I guess weekly nature program on television, and his wife hosts it. So I guess this program isn't released in, like, seasons or anything, because they're just constantly on the road, no matter, like, what time of year it is. But in order to create this show, they live inside of, they call it a ComV. I'm not entirely sure why, but it's an RV that's been, like, retrofitted with, like, sort of, like, fantastical technology to be able to, like, sustain, like, itself in any environment. And their two daughters and their feral son and their chimpanzee all live with them in this RV as they travel all over the world and make this show. It's most focused on the youngest daughter, Eliza, who, as we mentioned, has the ability to talk to animals, which is a secret. And basically, most standard episodes involve the parents being like, we're going to go try and film this thing. Like, Debbie, watch Donnie. And then Eliza fucks off into the woods and imperils herself. And then doesn't die. And then comes home and her parents don't seem to know that anything happened. And also the whole time, Donnie is fucking up Debbie's entire life. And Debbie's like, please, for the love of God, let me just read a magazine. So that's your standard episode.
And that really, I mean, it's very funny because in that sense, it's very formulaic because it really, most of the time, it really just is that. And they do a lot within that. Obviously, the environment is kind of a character in the show because it's not, it's episodic, but episodes were produced where the family is traveling within a region of the world for a couple of episodes. So, for example, they'll be traveling in the Amazonian basin for 4 or 5 episodes. They'll be traveling in Australia, across, like, in different parts of Australia for a couple of episodes. What's very frustrating as a viewer of the show is that they aired these out of order. And it is so frustrating. Because
I can't, like, find anything about that, but it's very obvious because they'll be, like, in Australia for, like, 3 episodes, suddenly in Africa, then back to Australia for 2 episodes, and then back to the same part of Africa. But, like, you know, there's clearly plot lines where they're, like, traveling south through Africa that get disrupted by random episodes where suddenly they're, like, in Sumatra or something. And it's, like, they clearly wrote these stories with a path of travel that makes logical sense. And Nickelodeon was like, fuck all of the effort that you put into that. Like, we're just going to air them in a random order. That seems obvious to me.
Yeah. And I mean, they do go to the Galapagos, for example, when they're in South America. But the Galapagos is in South America, broadly speaking.
That one actually did bother me because they acted like the Galapagos was not that far away from Ecuador. And it is. It's far away.
Yeah.
Far away. Like, if they had, like, Tierra del Fuego and they'd acted like, oh, the Galapagos, like, isn't really that far. It's not, like, a huge deal. That would make sense. But they weren't. They were in Ecuador.
Also, on that episode where they sail from Australia to India, it takes them, like, 12 hours. And I'm pretty sure that India is further away from that.
Yeah, like generously, they were on that boat for like 24 hours, and I'm pretty sure that passage takes several days, because they were on like sort of like, you know, like a barge. Like, those don't move that fast.
Yeah, it was basically a glorified
container ship.
Yeah, so.
They travel on the Ever Given and they block the Suez Canal.
The show plays fast and loose with time.
It does. It does. Yeah. There are, like, I would say, like, so they did, one of the aims of the show actually was to be educational. It seems like they did get some money from the government for educational stuff, and they had animal experts as consultants on the show. So most of the animal stuff is pretty accurate. Most of the cultural stuff about, like, other cultures is pretty, like, respectfully done, even if it's not like anthropologically, you know, perfect. Like even though they're spending time with like Maasai people and like people who live in the Andean mountain, like Andes mountains, I never feel like, whoo, this is like racist, which it I kind of expected to feel that way. And I didn't, which I think is really to the credit of the show.
Yeah, I think that there are a couple of places where I'm like, like, for example, when they're in the Amazonian basin, they stumble upon a hunter-gatherer society. They're clearly modeled after a real hunter. Like, the cultural motifs they show are clearly based on something. I did not look up the specific...
Probably the Yanomamo.
That was my first guess, but I didn't just kind of want to write it off. But they stumble upon...
It gives the implication that this is an uncontacted community.
Yeah.
They don't ever explicitly say that, but they just kind of let you come to that conclusion, you know?
And, like, the punchline of the episode is that, no, they are contacted. They have cell phones and computers in these huts without power lines, and they all speak English. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, okay, first of all, if they spoke any outside language, it would be fucking Portuguese.
Or maybe Spanish.
Or maybe Spanish. And second, like, at first I was like, oh, this sucks. But, like, what are they going to do? They have an English family. Are they just not going to allow them to talk? So, like, in places where I feel like, no, these people probably wouldn't speak English, or if they did, it would be very, a basic level of fluency. Not saying that people can't learn English, right? But it's weird to expect everyone in the world to speak English.
Yeah, but at the same time, like, if they didn't, then it wouldn't allow these characters to interact with any other people anywhere, you know? But I will say it's one of those things where it's like, I think the point of that was to try to be like, because it's also the adults that do that with this group of people. Like, you should not assume that people are unsophisticated or culturally backward because of certain, you know, aspects of material culture or sartorial choices or things like that. Like, you can't know anything about someone and their culture just by looking at them. And, like, as, like, Westerners, we shouldn't be, like, chauvinists and assume that these other people are backward or less than us, right? I think that's the point they're trying to make. And, like, I think that's a really good point, too. But I also think it, one, portrays the situation of people living in that kind of environment is very rosy. And for two, they believe that they have discovered an uncontacted Amazonian tribe, and Marianne's first instinct is to walk into their village with her camera and start fucking filming them. Which, like, Nigel stops her immediately, but I don't think he does a good enough job of explaining why what she was doing is wrong. Because, like, questions of, like, exploitation aside, like, these people are not animals. What the fuck, right? Questions of that aside, he's like, whoa, 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 whoa. Hey, they've, like, if these people are an uncontacted tribe, they've probably never seen this type of technology. We could do, you know, he does, like, a prime directive thing, essentially, which is part of it, you know, where it's like, if we, like, show up with all of this weird technology, it could really, like, unsettle things for them. It could do damage, like, potentially irreparable damage to their culture and to their social fabric and blah, 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 blah. So we have to, like, be really very careful if we're going to go speak to them. But they shouldn't be going to go speak to them anyway, actually, because the global policy of everyone on Earth is to not contact uncontacted tribes, actually. The policy is that, like, even in the Amazon, like, if you encounter evidence that there is an uncontacted tribe near you, you are supposed to fucking leave. You are not supposed to contact them, because as a society, we have determined that the risks and harms to that group of people are far too great to make, like making contact with those people worth it in any way? And also there's an extent to which with a lot of these groups that are still uncontacted at this point, it's like they're still uncontacted at this point because they want to be. You know, they don't want to interact. Like at the Andaman Islands, right? A couple of years ago, that fucking idiot guy was going to go be a missionary to them and he got killed. They've made it very clear to the rest of the world a lot over the last like 150 years or so that they are not interested in being in contact with the rest of the world. That's why it's actually illegal to do what he was doing, because it's like, hey, don't do this. They will kill you. Because they are not interested in being in contact with us, for probably good reason. So the fact that, like, Marianne's instinct was so profoundly fucked up, and the way that Nigel explained why she shouldn't do that and was wrong, actually touches on, like, the very smallest part of why that's wrong. But that is the part that sets them up for the punchline, so.
And yes, there is a punchline to mm-hmm. many of the episodes, and yeah. Most of those, of course, are at Eliza's expense. And the show follows this pattern, but there were a lot of things like this feels we've done a couple of these lately where watching them as adults is such a profoundly different experience than watching them mm-hmm. as children, right? That was our biggest criticism, like not our criticism, but our biggest sticking point with Kids Next Door. And we talked a little bit about it with Rocco's Modern Life on the other end, where it's like, oh, as an adult, this is almost more enjoyable because mm-hmm. this is very clearly tapping into what it's kind of like to be a young adult in a crazy mm-hmm. world. But as a kid, I remember being like, wow, Eliza, she's going out and she's doing these things. And at the very least, I thought, oh, this is fine. But as an adult, I'm watching her behavior and I'm like, oh my God, I could start a red flag store with all the red flags that I have to sell.
For sure. Like, how many times did I text you, Eliza's such a dumb bitch?
Yeah.
I texted you, Eliza's such a dumb bitch, like 5 times before you started watching. And then you started watching and you immediately texted me, these children are unsupervised.
All caps. I sent a lot of all caps messages, which I don't normally do.
Sure. Because I responded to that when I was like, they're always unsupervised. You're going to need to get used to this.
And
yeah, okay, so do we want to discuss Eliza and her insane behavior?
Right, so if you're here to have us tell you the plot of The Wild Thornberries, too bad. We've already done it. I will say there were 91 episodes. We watched collectively maybe a third to not a half, between a third and a half mm-hmm. of the show. We didn't watch the movie, which, yes, there's a movie. I think there are two movies, or maybe just one.
There's one theatrical release, and then there's the crossover with the Rugrats.
Yeah.
Yeah, but like, I don't know. It's not like it's not really very serialized. It's not heavily plot driven. And for the stuff that is like a big reveal or whatever, we read the synopses, and so we know it's fine.
It ran till 2004, which means that it was firmly in what we consider to be Nickelodeon's kind of like golden period. And it slid out of the DMs before things kind of started to fall apart. So yeah. It was a very popular show. Like, despite all the things we're gonna say, like, it was very popular. It won a variety of awards, though it never won an Annie, which is kind of like our
Weird. Yeah, it didn't win any Annies. Did it win any Emmys?
It did not win any Emmys. It won Genesis Awards. So it basically won awards related to animal and environmentalism causes. So, like, it won the Environmental Media Award. It won the Genesis Award, which is the award given to media that increases awareness of the environment. So it ultimately, it really seems to have made the biggest splash for increasing awareness surrounding environmental and animal rights issues, which it does very well.
And it's also, even when you Google it, its genre is listed as nature. So I think it actually, I think that the show was kind of like categorized as a nature or educational program. And that kind of closed it out of getting some of the recognition that it probably deserves. It kind of seems like it got the short shrift because it's a very well-remembered and well-regarded show. And the animation is great. And like it has solid storytelling and it's very entertaining. So I think that it's one of those things where it's like, it is remembered like better than was like acknowledged in terms of like award recognition at the time.
It's because it's the world music of cartoons. Basically, it got
everyone was like, what is this PBS shit?
Yeah, I was just about to say, it almost seems like something that, if it weren't for how crazy dangerous so much of it is, it almost seems like it would have been a PBS show. So I just, before we started digging into it, I did kind of want to place it in its time, and it's in that golden age. It's Klasky Supo. It won some awards. Like people, and if a show's connection to memes is any indication of its like archaeological significance, Nigel Thornberry is very heavily, heavily memed. So,
you know what's interesting also is that in terms of like I briefly would like to touch on like character design, because the character models are interesting. So Nigel Thornberry is mostly nose, which is interesting. Eliza, they said they intentionally designed the original character model the animator said, quote, "to be frank, to be very ugly." And they wanted to do that because they wanted to like go against the idea that like young heroines have to be pretty. But Nickelodeon requests that they like cuten her up a little bit. And I'm like, if this is the cutened up version, they must have, yeah, made her look like grotesque. Because like Eliza is not cute. Like she is unfortunate looking, you know? So, but I think that's interesting that they were trying to be like, well, she doesn't have to be cute. She has like other qualities, you know?
Well, yeah. And one of those qualities is being a dumb,
to being a dumb bitch.
I'm sorry. Listen, I hate to say it, y'all, but Eliza should not be alive. If this show touches on evolution so much, she would have won so many Darwin Awards.
Oh yeah, for sure.
Those of you,
yeah, dude, okay.
For those of you who aren't aware, a Darwin Award is a satirical award given posthumously to an individual who, through acts of misadventure, mostly due to absolute stupidity, have removed themselves from the gene pool.
Yeah, they've done humanity a favor by removing themselves from the gene pool. One last character models, though. Debbie.
Sure. What about Debbie?
Does she feel maybe a little bit too sexy?
I mean, she shows midriff a lot.
Yeah.
But I don't know. Her boobs aren't super big, and
I don't know, but I feel like her, like, something about the way that they're drawn, like, definitely, like, her boobs are very apparent. She has, like,
but she's 16.
The most bodacious tatas of any other teen girl we've seen in the show. You know, and she's supposed to, in any show, really, and she's supposed to be 16, and I'm like, why are her, do they just, like, do other shows mostly just draw boobs as, like, a general curve, and they draw each of her boobs as, like, a separate object, like, in reality, and that's why? But I feel like it's not like they draw her with huge boobs, but I feel like her boobs are more prominent and noticeable than, like, other women, but especially teenage girls in other shows we've watched, and I'm like, it makes me feel weird.
I mean, I'm looking at a picture of Debbie right now, and I mean, her boobs are more clearly outlined, and I think part of that is because she's the okay, so two things. I think they look so visually prominent because both of them are drawn instead of just one curve to represent both boobs. And yes. Two, the way the character model works is she's wearing that tube top.
Yeah.
With midriff and big baggy jeans. And I think the visual line across her chest of the mid mm-hmm. the shirt outlines them, and so it makes them feel more prominent.
Yeah, because I was about to say, like, we even talked about how we thought, like, the characters in Kim Possible had, like, kind of, like, a surprising amount of boob. But when you look at all of them, they all just have, like, one curve that's drawn to represent the concept of boobs, right? I kind of feel like I can't really think of many other characters in Western children's animation that I've seen with two independently animated boobs.
Yeah, I mean,
and so it makes them seem prominent.
But I'm looking at them and they're defined, but I wouldn't say that they're like big or sexy. They're just present.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, and like boobs aren't inherently sexual or anything. I guess it's just more.
And the rest of her vibe is very baggy and very.
Yeah, definitely. Like, definitely. Grunge.
So I think. The point is well taken, but also I feel like the rest of her is very, like, flowy and rough, that it doesn't feel like they do a sexy girl trope.
No, they don't at all. I think, actually, that's a really interesting thing about, like, animation, and I guess is worth noting. Like, oh, I guess I didn't really think about how they draw boobs in cartoons. And I didn't really think about how if they drew boobs slightly different than that, it would be really noticeable and give, like, a different vibe.
Because, yeah, the girls in Kim Possible were definitely more sexy because they were curvy, right? They were very curvy and very busty. Whereas, like, Debbie is all straight lines.
What's funny is clearly a lot of, clearly a lot of little boys were into it because I'm seeing a lot of sexy Debbie Thornberry cosplays.
And I'm at Rule 34, I'm sure, which is weird because she's an underage girl. But the internet's going to be the internet, I guess.
Yep.
all right. Eliza. Let's talk about Eliza because mm-hmm. she's the, you know, the titular main character here. And mm-hmm. she should be dead because she's an idiot.
Yeah. She constantly makes decisions that are so profoundly dangerous. So she did almost freeze to death in the Andes and her father rescued her.
She almost gets eaten by alligators, lions, jaguars.
He almost gets eaten by crocodiles on, like, many occasions.
All right, Eliza's interesting because her lack of smart decision making drives mm-hmm. every plot with her in the show, and mm-hmm. it's important because it provides conflict and it provides action. But Eliza's an interesting case study in what if we give a kid magical powers? And I think in that respect, it's pretty on the nose where kids are going to do not give kids magic powers because they will be stupid with them. And like mm-hmm. Eliza has a god complex where she has no conception of her own mortality. She's arrogant. Mm-hmm. I think she does this thing that is actually kind of good for educational purposes, where she assumes that just because she can communicate with other animals, that alone will make everything hunky-dory.
Yeah, and it doesn't. Like, there's an episode in which he almost destroys the entire ecosystem of a Galapagos island because she has a god complex, basically. Like, she gives a finch a needle to get grubs out of a hole, and that the Galapagos, a famously delicate and untouched ecosystem, she like literally almost destroys it by doing that. She completely upsets the balance of the food chain utterly, and creates a huge problem. And it's only by like going throughout the island and taking back all the needles that she gave to the finches that she's able to like set things to rights. But also, we all know that at that point it would be too late. It's already fucked up, you know? Like, it's fucked up until, like they ate all those grubs. Did they eat all of the grubs? Because if they did, that's all of the larva of that bug. So now that bug is extinct there. And things are fucked, you know? Or, like, there's a time, like, you cannot tell her that she cannot or should not do anything. Like, she also sees no real difference between saying, I don't think you're capable of doing that, which she does not like and will try to prove you wrong immediately, and saying, it is not wise for you to do that. Like, saying, it is not wise for you to do that is to her identical to saying, you are not capable of doing that. And so, therefore, she wants to prove you wrong by doing it, and it leads her to make incredibly reckless decisions.
And then she's so smarmy about it to Darwin when she magically manages to make it work, even though objectively it was a bad decision from the beginning. Like, Darwin, okay, so Darwin and Eliza are our like duo that drive a lot of the A stories, where Darwin is the anxious one who's like, Eliza, like cloying, anxious, neurotic, Eliza, you shouldn't be doing these things. And she's always like, Darwin, you're a fucking idiot, shut up. She doesn't say that, obviously, in so many adult words, but
she might as well, honestly. She's mean about it.
She's not nice to Darwin.
No. And she's actually not nice to anybody, but we can get into that later.
So Eliza,
what, like,
has
like,
the gall,
yes, Darwin
to...
is Darwin is super anxious, but like often he is exhibiting reasonable fear and concern. like he has a clear understanding of the situation.
Yeah, and you could argue it's so weird that Eliza puts so much stock in interacting with animals, but she doesn't trust the instincts of a once wild animal with her. And yeah, so many problems could have been avoided had she just listened to Darwin's anxious cloying, because he's right most of the time. He's like, dude, that hyena should want to kill you. That lion is gonna eat your face. Why are you not listening to me?
Yeah, just because you can talk to them doesn't mean they don't have instincts anymore. She won't even trust his instincts about chimpanzees. He is a chimpanzee who, from things he said, like, he was not raised in captivity. He was, like, they imply that, that Darwin just, like, really wanted to live a human lifestyle, so he intentionally, like, tagged along with the Thornberries. That's the implication. But, like, he lived with, like, a troop of chimpanzees. He, like, grew up as a chimpanzee. He knows what the situation is. And they are encountering chimpanzees in the wild, and he's trying to tell her what the deal is. And she's like, Darwin, fuck off. You don't know what you're talking about. Like, everything's totally fine. I know what I'm doing. And she won't listen to Darwin when he's trying to explain to her how other chimpanzees work.
It's hard for me to know if the show meant for her to essentially be a negative parable. Like, don't be like Eliza.
Like, there are times, definitely. Like, there are lessons that Eliza learns. But I feel like, I'm just like, okay, there are specific lessons, but I feel like just generally her behavior is, like, not ideal, you know? In the last episode I watched, she had, like, there, like, Through no fault of her own, an Ai-Ai had ended up in a village of people who were like, Ai-Ais are bad luck, we have to kill the Ai-Ai. And she's like, doesn't want that to happen. So she's trying to like get it to go home. And she is putting herself in insane amounts of danger to do so. To the point where she has, and also because she doesn't want to believe bad luck exists. Like she says, bad luck doesn't exist, it's just a superstition. She's really dismissive to the point that her mom actually scolds her for being culturally insensitive. And to the point where they fall off a fucking cliff and she's like hanging from a branch and holding Donnie and Darwin's hanging from a branch and holding the Ai-Ai and she intentionally tickles Darwin's armpit until he lets go and then she lets go herself with her baby brother in her hand into water where immediately beneath them there are two crocodiles. Like, what the fuck? You just almost killed all of you because you cannot admit that you were wrong and you cannot weigh the danger to yourself, your brother, and your family's chimp against the danger to one lemur that you don't know that well when you have the possibility that you can, like, talk through this with these people and get them to see reason. Like, what the fuck? That's insane.
Yeah, and even in situations where Eliza is going to try to free a hippo who has been captured by poachers.
Hippos are so dangerous.
It's very funny because that episode portrays hippos as stupid, like, what, Eliza? Mm-hmm. And like, nice. Hippos are vicious creatures.
Yeah, hippos are terrifying.
But Eliza basically risks being completely lost from her family and in a river alone with no way to survive for a hippo. Now, yeah. I'm not saying that hippos aren't important, but
yeah,
it's weird because she takes on all these risks and you feel like she's the hero of this situation and she does in fact save the hippo, but mm-hmm. her actions explicitly almost cause an entire ship of people to sink into the river.
Yeah, dude. Like, it's one of those things where it's like, yes, like caring about animals is great. Like wanting to help animals is wonderful, but for one, like, her risk to reward ratio is completely skewed because she's 12, right? Like she does not seem to comprehend that the mortal danger that she is putting herself in when she risks these things. And by the way, she's not always risking her life to like save an animal's life, which she is. Like these examples, she's trying to save an animal's life. And so she risks her life. She sometimes risks her life just to do something like cool or like help somebody out with like a pretty minor problem or something like that. And then when that's not what's happening, she's actually like fucking shit up in the environment because she thinks she knows everything and she's 12. And so she does, like, the Galapagos Island example is not the only example of that. She like fucks shit up for animals constantly because she thinks she knows best when she doesn't.
She almost gets her and her dad killed underwater because she brazenly believes that she can do two things at once, even though her dad is like, are you sure? I should probably do that. And yes, mm-hmm. I hear you saying, dear listener, well, shouldn't Nigel have forced her to listen? Yeah, he should have, but he doesn't. And that's a perfect segue into why is Eliza such a shithead? Well, it probably is because their parents are completely absent.
Yes. These children are constantly unsupervised. Like, so for one, like, I just am not sure that, like, if this is the lifestyle that Marianne and Nigel always had or wanted to have, I feel like maybe they shouldn't have had children. And if they made the decision to begin living this lifestyle at some point during their children's lives, I feel like they should have like reconsidered that, or maybe when the girls reached a certain age, it was time to stop doing that, because it's causing actually a lot of problems that they live this lifestyle, for one. And for two, even then, they're not ever with their fucking children. They're always like, all right, we're gonna like go on a helicopter ride so that we can get like footage of like a bird in the air. We'll see you guys in 9 hours. And they just fuck off, right? Constantly leaving their 16-year-old daughter in charge of the feral child they adopted, which like... I like, you know, parentification discourse has gone way too far. And like, I'm not going to say it's parentification or whatever, but I don't think that their 16-year-old daughter should be in charge of the 4-year-old feral child as much as she is. Debbie is too responsible for Donnie too much of the time. And then because she's 16 and she doesn't want to hang out with her sister anyway, and she doesn't give a shit what her sister does, and because they didn't explicitly say, watch Eliza, Eliza then also fucks off into the woods with Darwin and puts herself in mortal peril. Sometimes she puts Debbie in mortal peril too because of whatever she's done. Like, and just like their parents almost never find out that it even happened. They come back and they're like, oh, okay, whatever. It's just like, whatever went on. It's like, you have no involvement in your daughter's lives. You don't know what's going on. Your daughter leapt into a river today and was almost eaten by crocodiles.
Yeah, this is one of those things where you could say, well, you know, you guys sound like those people who call the cops on parents who let their 7-year-old walk the block to school or whatever. And yes, you know, again, parenting discourse is grotesque nowadays, but this isn't that. They're in dangerous places in the wilderness with no help, for hours and hours. Like, snakes, spiders, falls, like, all of these things are present.
Big cats, a starving lion comes into their camp and tries to eat Eliza and Darwin one time, dude. Like that wasn't even Eliza going and doing something dangerous out on her own. It just so happened that she and Darwin were the only ones in camp, and there was a starving lion, and he came into their camp and tried to eat them.
So the fact that their parents make absolutely, basically no attempt to mitigate those risks and flagrantly disregard that there are risks. Oh my God, their parents are so irresponsible. I'm not saying you have to watch your kid every second of the day, but if you're in, like, if I go to the woods, I'm gonna check where my kids are every hour.
Yeah, for sure. Like they have like shortwave radio and stuff. Like it's easy enough for them to be like, we have the radio and we're going to call and check in with you once an hour. And like, if you don't respond to us within 5 minutes when we check in on you, it doesn't matter whether you were safe or unsafe. Like, you're in trouble. You know, like if you don't respond within 5 minutes for whatever reason, like when we get back, you're in trouble, you know, because we need to be able to contact you and know what you're doing and know what's going on, because it also means they are not in any way enforcing their schooling. Neither of those girls do their schoolwork like at all. And their parents aren't paying attention to it. They're not concerned. They're not making sure that they follow through with doing their schoolwork. It's shocking to me that they're even literate, honestly.
Well, Marianne. Marianne cares about those things, but she's so overwhelmed by every responsibility. She cooks, she cleans, she's their mechanic, she edits video, she's doing all the time-intensive tasks. She literally cannot manage all of it on her own. And Nigel is ADHD.
He's away with the fairies.
Yeah, he's away with the fairies. So we get this situation where even if they were around all the time, there's no indication that Nigel would be an active parent. Like, he's got a lot of qualities of a good father. He's kind, he's gentle, he is knowledgeable, but he lacks any sort of hard skills that would allow Marianna break. So,
like, the Thornberries are like, they're loving, they're supportive, they're available, you know, it like emotionally available to their daughters. And I guess technically, like, in this lifestyle, they're, you know, with them all the time. They're with them every night, even if they go work during the day or whatever. But they are so, like, laissez-faire. Like, they are inattentive. Like, they do not place, like, real strictures on their children to the extent, like, they have so few boundaries for their children and their children's behavior that they don't actually even know what their children are doing. Because we see Marianne say, no, Eliza, you can't do that. That's very dangerous. And so we know that if she knew some of the stuff that was going on, she would be like, holy fuck, no. But she doesn't even know because she can't. She has so few boundaries right now. She doesn't even know what's going on to know when to put up a guardrail for her children.
Yeah, this is right. Parenting styles go authoritarian, authoritative, permissive. There is also the uninvolved parenting style, which is like more of an absence of a parenting style than anything else. And It's so weird because they swing between permissive and uninvolved.
Yeah. Like, because it's like they clearly love their children and they're like emotionally involved, but like they just are not like paying attention to like behaviors and like what they're doing, you know, and they're too sort of like focused on their work. And I think that like, in addition to just like leaving their children completely unsupervised, leaving their oldest daughter in charge of a feral child constantly, like not knowing that they're putting themselves in constant danger, not making sure they're doing their schooling, I also think the lifestyle that they've chosen to live is inherently a problem because it's a problem for the girls' socialization. Like, we see Eliza is clearly not well socialized to people her age because we see her interact with people her age and she is, except for that like one boy she has a crush on, she is like so dismissive of other kids her age. Other kids her age, she's like either dismissive of them and just like doesn't really care about hanging out with them, or she is like actively clearly annoyed by the presence of the other child. Like, there's like the Inuit boy who just wants to hang out and he's being pretty chill, and she's just like being kind of like shady and trying to avoid him and doesn't want to hang out. And then there's like a girl on Madagascar who wants to hang out with her, who it's very clear that Eliza is annoyed by her and does not want her around and wants her to fuck off. There's never shown any reason with these characters why she would behave that way. And it's actually kind of completely uncommented on. It's not really part of the plot or the lesson in any way. They're just showing Eliza being weird and dismissive of these other kids. And I assume that part of it is because she has the ability to talk to animals, which has to remain secret or else she will lose that ability. And she wants to go talk to animals or whatever. But it also shows me that she is not properly socialized because she's like, she does not want to take advantage of like encountering children her own age. She's dismissive of them. She doesn't want to be around them. She wants to be by herself with just animals. And even when we see her interact with the Maasai children, it's in like a weird competitive way, you know, where it's more about her insisting that she is capable of doing literally anything and everything, and is like better than these other children. She's not interacting with them in like a healthy way, you know?
Yeah, she, this is kind of the problem with giving a child the ability to talk to animals too, is that people spend their entire lives learning how to communicate with their own species. And she's not going through any of that with her. She'll be a menace as an adult. It's weird because the premise is if you can talk to animals, you can better understand the world and you'll be a better person because of it. But a person like that might also end up being pretty dismissive of human needs too.
She is. Yeah.
And that's like she completely doesn't ever think about her sister.
She, like, thinks that her sister is, like, a piece of shit, basically. Like, she thinks her sister is, like, dumb and, like, pointless as a person, you know? And it's interesting because the Wikipedia describes Debbie as a popular teenage girl. And I'm like, how? She's not popular. There's no other people around for her to be popular with. Like, popular indicates that there are other people around who like you, and there are no other people around. Plus, she's, like, alternative, so I don't think she would be that popular anyway. But, like, Debbie is portrayed as, a typical moody teenage girl or whatever, but I actually think Debbie is having a completely appropriate and honestly mild and very well-adjusted response to the situation that she's living in.
Yeah, Debbie is able to interact with other people her own age. She shows an interest in doing so. She gets annoyed when her parents fuck off and tell her to take care of everything, which, yeah, of course.
That's reasonable. Yeah.
That's a reasonable, like, why do I have to watch a feral child?
Yeah.
So I really, Debbie is well adjusted, she's normal, and I feel like she gets shat on so much that,
because it's like the things that she describes that she wants are time to herself, privacy, her own space, and the ability to interact with other people her age, otherwise known as things that are completely reasonable to want and that all teenagers want, and that is a huge part of being a teenager. That you always start to differentiate yourself as an adult from your family by, like, needing privacy and space and, like, interaction with your peer group. And all of that is taken away from her by this lifestyle. We see where they sleep. Their beds are just, like, in, like, the place where the girls sleep is just the middle of the fucking convi. She doesn't have, like, even, like, there's not even a curtain. The only place that she could possibly have privacy ever is, like, the bathroom.
Yeah, it's not a lifestyle for raising children. It's really not. The Thornberries, even if the Thornberries were perfect at doing it, you would still have criticisms of moving people around. I mean, shit, people talk about the problems with, like, military brats, and at least they live in environments for a couple of years, at least, usually, where they interact with other people and go to school and have access to, you know, a modern lifestyle. Even they talk about how disorienting that is for them. And then you see this and it's just turned up to fucking 11.
I knew a couple of girls who, right as they became teenagers, their dad retired from the military and was like, we're gonna go live, our family of four, in a cabin cruiser boat, not like a houseboat or anything like that, just a regular cabin cruiser boat, pretty small, and you guys are gonna be homeschooled. And even then, they mostly had their boat docked at, like, a couple of the same marinas. So they did have interactions with other families that were living this lifestyle, and they were around other kids, and, like, their schooling was enforced and things like that. Both those girls have a very strained relationship with their parents now. And they're like, this was very bad for us. And it was, definitely.
Children just do not respond well to a nomadic lifestyle like that.
So, like, it's isolating. Like,
it's one thing if you live in a nomadic community, right? Obviously, there are human societies that are nomadic, but the core difference is that those societies pick up their entire community and move with them, right? So in that respect, there's stability in that. And you move at appointed times, right? You move with the seasons, or you move when an area's resources are exhausted to a certain point. And you know, and everybody is like, it's a part of your culture how you deal with being a nomad. And so that isn't nearly as problematic as, like, a single family unit just fucking moving around whenever
within a sedentary culture. And it's not just that they're having, like, that the children aren't being properly socialized in the sense of they're not being socialized among their peer groups. They're just not even being socialized at all with any people outside of their nuclear family. And that's, like, It seems like Debbie had enough time before they started living this way that she's fairly well adjusted, even though she's feeling like, I would say that Debbie is at a very high risk for depression and anxiety, probably, because of like the isolation and like lack of privacy and lack of ability to do the major things that teens feel driven to do, you know?
Straight up boredom.
Yeah, she's fucking bored constantly. Like, she's obsessed with this magazine because it's the only thing she consistently has, you know? And also it's like, what, like, how, like, Amazon didn't exist then. So it's like, even if she's like, well, I want to read books instead, how's she going to fucking get them, you know? Whereas Eliza, I don't think was had enough time that she was very well socialized before they started doing that.
No, not at all. And even if Debbie had stuff to do, she couldn't do it because she's constantly watching the feral child. Let's talk about the feral child.
Yes. Oh my God. Let's talk about the feral child.
Donnie's parents were colleagues of the Thornberries who were killed by poachers. And so the Thornberries found Donnie, who had been raised by orangutans. So number one, again, orangutans are not the ones that you want raising kids. They're the most isolated socially of all the great apes. But anyway, right? So Donnie was raised by an orangutan, and so he is feral. He can't speak English. He gibbers. He's constantly running around and wild and doesn't understand like human customs at all. So
just like eats things,
just eats random things. So he's a menace, right? He's and you know, it's not his fault. He's a child, but he needs a therapist.
Yeah, so here's the thing too. It's like, okay, so Donnie is 4 now, and it seems like he's been with the Thornberries long enough that they've adjusted. So let's say they've had him for like a year. So he would have been about 3. So, you know, even if he was like a baby when his parents were killed, let's say he was 6 months old, that still would have been like a year and a half, maybe 2.5 years that he was in the wild and a very pliable developmental stage. And he would have been gotten by those humans at a very pliable developmental stage. And he's been with them for a while now. I feel like he should be progressing and he isn't. And it's because they're not doing what they need to do to make sure that happens.
Yeah, Nigel has this weird fucking obsession with understanding Donnie's condition, but no interest in helping him learn. Like, they
it's
sort
like
of...
we have a lot of documentation about feral children. You can research it, you know?
He's before the age of 6. So he should be able to hear language and learn language. Mm-hmm. He may be developmentally delayed, but he's not beyond the critical period. So
yeah, he's within the range where he should be able to be with time, like progress and be socialized relatively normally, just like on a delayed schedule, and he would need extra supports.
And the Thornberries are like, they're actually completely derelict in their duties. Like,
oh yeah,
this is actually a huge indictment of both Nigel and Marianne. Donnie should be sent somewhere. If they're gonna refuse to settle and focus all of their efforts on his development, he needs to be given away to somebody to some organization or somebody that will attempt to do that, because
even other colleagues that are more sedentary, because it seems like, you know, there's like a whole group of people that they knew. Other people knew these parents of his, you know, like, because the thing is like, even in this, for one, like, actually the environment they live, the lifestyle they live, replicates some of the issues with being raised and being a feral child, like with lack of socialization and exposure to just like other people. But also, like, even just, like, even living this lifestyle, living with your family for about a year, if you were, and you talk about Donnie's English lessons or whatever, if you were making any kind of effort at all to helping him develop, he would be able to speak more than he speaks by that point. You know, we hear him say, like, maybe two English words, like, throughout things. And it's like, I feel like if with the amount of time he's been with them, he should at least be capable of, like, not constantly just gibbering and nonsense anymore. But he's not, and that's, like, really concerning.
It sucks because he's supposed to be kind of, like, the comedic relief of the show. Like, he's crying. Mm-hmm. He's, like, supposed to draw in young kids, too.
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. be fun and exciting and wacky. But, you know, the whole point is that we're taking this perspective to analyze this media. And mm-hmm. it's really, really... Like, if you take it seriously, right? It's really sad that...
Yeah, it's tragic.
It's so weird because the basic... This is one of those premises that I feel like there are a lot of shows that are so stylized that your disbelief gets suspended a lot. Like Kids Next Door. Like,
mm-hmm.
like 2x4 punk. Like, it's so outlandish that...
Yeah.
Whatever. But this is so grounded in so yeah. many other ways that...
Except for, like, Eliza being able to talk to animals and the outlandish stuff the combi can do, this is a completely realistic, like, premise. There are people who live this way.
And even the villains, poachers, documentarians who force animals to fight, like, all of the... They're cartoonish villains, but they're all realistic. Like, yeah, you better fucking believe there are going to be some Europeans forcing animals to fight for entertainment. 100%. Yeah, that that's a thing. Poachers,
yep.
like, stealing animals for ivory? Of mm-hmm. course. Soldiers, like, there's an episode where Eliza goes to a safari and she's like, it's so mean that fence is electrified. And the game warden says, well, unfortunately, it is, but unfortunately, there are many people who would attempt to kill these animals, so we have to protect them, and that requires us to hurt them a little sometimes to protect them. And Eliza mm-hmm. won't get it through her fucking skull that is a necessary evil, because she can't understand yeah. it. But mm-hmm. that moment is so grounding that
mm-hmm.
when you see shit like Donnie... It mm-hmm. completely takes it complete. You're essentially forced to view it with a realistic lens. And the only answer you come up with is, wow, the Thornberries are like derelict in their duties.
Yeah, it's like, you know, if you guys were like, I feel like by this point, you should have been able to adjust him to wearing a shirt. Right? Like, it's like, at this point, like, you should be insisting on him wearing at least a shirt, and he should be able to wear a shirt most of the time without tearing it off. I understand that shoes might be hard, shoes feel really weird, but you should also be working on shoes. Like, I feel like you've had Donnie long enough that you should have been through shirt and be on to working on shoes. Like, Donnie's running around barefoot with no shirt in trunks all the time. Like, what? That's not... For one, it's not safe.
It's almost like they treat him as a house guest and not as a member of their family.
They treat him essentially the same as they treat Darwin.
Which
is also inappropriate. You should not keep great apes. You should not keep really any primates, but especially great apes as pets.
Yeah, so Donnie just completely pulls me out and is sad. And we know mm-hmm. that he's young enough that he could be well adjusted. So,
yep.
Darwin, right, so when I was growing up, I feel like primate ownership really peaked in the 90s.
Mm.
Because I knew multiple families or acquaintances of, like, my dad that had monkeys. And
multiple people.
Yeah.
And wow. I blame Michael Jackson and Friends.
I do too. This. all of them eventually had to get rid of them because they all became aggressive, which...
Yeah.
Yeah, like, of course.
Obviously.
Looking back, I try not to think about those moments too hard because they make me want to cry. Because those people were raising those animals in isolated cages with... It just straight up animal abuse. And
because also they probably, it was probably just ignorance. They probably loved that animal and thought they were treating really well, you know.
They did, but they were completely you know, the fact that they
could private individuals are not equipped to care for primates.
The fact that somebody sold those animals, those are the true monsters.
Yes, exactly.
And Darwin wandered into the Thornberry's household and they allowed him to stay.
Mm-hmm.
But the conceit is that Darwin likes living like a human and has the intellect of a human too. And because even when he can't be understood by Eliza, he's capable of showing human level thought. And that breaks the conceit. Again, it's so grounded in so many other ways, but you're like, oh yeah, it's cool that Darwin lives with them because he wants to. But like at the same time, you should never own a great ape.
Yeah, no.
And
no,
making
shouldn't.
Kids think it's cool that she lives with a monkey is actually kind of shitty. Like,
yeah, I mean, like, I'm looking and trying to see, like, how he became a part of their household. But it's unclear. It says that he met the Thornberrys as they were filming a show and befriended Eliza, like, before they could even speak to each other. But it's just, it's unclear.
It's found
unclear
Donnie.
How he became a part of their family.
They found Donnie and Darwin found them. That's in the intro.
Yeah, that's the description of the intro, yeah.
Darwin, this chimp literally just wandered up to them and they were like, okay, you can live with us now. Like, what the fuck?
Yeah, like at one point, like that's for one, it's like wildly irresponsible. Like Nigel and Marianne are supposed to be naturalists. Like,
they should know
like that's irresponsible.
They should know how dangerous chimpanzees are.
Yeah, they're incredibly dangerous. And actually, it's interesting because, like, we were talking about the chimpanzee episode before, and that's something that, like, Darwin was trying to tell Eliza. Like, Darwin was like, you don't understand, like, I'm, like, very chill, and I want to, like, hang out and eat Cheetos and stuff, but, like, chimpanzees are dangerous and they have a complex society with like a complex system of communication, and you have to be very careful or like you could get really, really hurt. And she doesn't listen to him, of course. You know,
why would Eliza listen to anybody? That's so passe. Yeah.
For real. Actually, okay, so that episode I think it's really interesting because it's trying to make a point about like cultural awareness, and I think it goes too far in one direction, actually, in a way that I think we normally do, right? Because basically Darwin is like, she wants to hang out with these chimpanzees and she keeps fucking up and really offending them because like chimpanzees have like a very complex system of like body language and like calls that they use to communicate with one another, and she keeps offending people, and they're also very hierarchical, and she keeps offending people really badly because also some human body language that is just totally normal means something very different to chimpanzees, right? Like she smiles and everyone's like, oh, what the fuck, you said there was danger or whatever. It's like, no, I didn't, I smiled, humans smile, right? And so she has to learn to like understand the way that they do things and appreciate that and adapt to their environment and like be respectful of them and meet them on their own terms, right? Great, that's a fantastic message. Like, respect other people's cultures when you go into other people's environments, like respect them, understand the way they do things, like when in Rome, blah, blah, blah. But on the other hand, like, they all know she's not a chimpanzee. Like, they all know that she, like, it's been made very clear that she does not know about nor understand chimpanzee ways of communicating, and that she is, like, making mistakes, and she's trying really hard. And they persist in being like, violently offended when she makes completely unintentional, like, and really not that harmful, like, cultural flubs, because she just doesn't know, right? And so that's how you end up on this other side. It's like, well, yeah, people should, like, respect your culture and try to adapt to it when they're in your environment, but you should also respect that they come from a different culture and are bringing all their stuff with them. Like, and you shouldn't expect people to have, like, perfect understanding of and compliance with the way, like, your culture in the exact way that you do things. Like, you should have awareness and understanding of them and their background, too, you know?
Yeah, to some extent, I think the idea is that she's intruding on them a lot. So it's more on her. But yeah, it ends up feeling like, come on, guys, give her a break. She's really trying. She's really trying. And that reminds me of, God, that other episode where Eliza is trying to get these lions not to eat her. So she has to pretend to hunt. And it's supposed to teach you that, like, oh, well, all these animals have their unique ways of doing things. And if you want to fit in, you got to make sure to do what they do. And they kind of do that with the humans they also interact with, too. So it's paralleled between, like, the animal societies and human societies, where Eliza's forced, in most cases, to learn, you know, people do these things these ways. And that overall, I think that message is more positive for kids than it is negative. But yeah, in this instance, it swings pretty far.
Yeah. And it's one of those things, like, I'm actually, I see it and I'm, like, kind of sensitive to it as, like, someone who was, like, you know, like, brought up and was in, like, environments and where, you know, being, like, the good whitey or whatever was, like, important. And, you know, I've run into issues where I'm, like, having conflict with a person and it's like, oh, well, I think, like, they said this thing I did that I felt was, like, completely normal and I was actually trying to be respectful. They thought it was, like, rude and disrespectful. So I guess it's, like, a cultural issue. And, like, had, like, other people in my life be like, well, no, they also need to respect your culture. It's not like they have no idea that you're not from there or where you're from or how that exact thing that you did is taken in the place where you're from. You know, like, yeah, they have that awareness too. So it's not 100% all on you all the time to bend over backwards if people are, like, taking stuff in bad faith, you know?
I feel like this is one of those things that cultures wide, like, vary a decent amount in how they do this. Like, for example, in my experience, if you try to speak Japanese with people who are Japanese, they are just chuffed that you are making an attempt. And will
most people actually are thrilled. Yeah.
Will forgive not using an honorific correctly, or will basically, like, meet you halfway. Like, sure, they may never fully accept you, like, as a pure member of their culture, but if you're a visitor and you're trying, they will be very good, very good natured about your attempt. Whereas, like, it's a common, like, stereotype that if you try to speak French to a Parisian, like, they'll be like, you suck. Your French sucks. Well,
they also are just like, I don't have, like, they're kind of like New Yorkers in that they're like, look, the issue is that I don't have time and I speak perfectly acceptable English and I just would rather get through this interaction, you know? But the thing is like, it's almost like in the situations I'm thinking of, like, it's not that other person who ever said I did anything culturally wrong. They were just, like, mad at me or offended by something I did. And I was being trained by all of the other people around me to say, like, well, like, there is a cultural divide. And if this person thinks that I've been rude, then that means it's because I have failed to be sufficiently culturally sensitive. Like, whereas in reality, like, people are people and sometimes people are assholes and take what you do in bad faith, right?
Right.
You know, where it, like, you know, and also there are different contexts, like, for example, like, there's a huge divide between like Japanese people in Japan and Japanese people in America in terms of like what they find acceptable for people who are like outsiders to do. Like people in like Japanese people from Japan are like, yeah, we like fucking love that you want to know about our culture. We think that's awesome. Like, so cool that you're trying to learn to speak it. Why would we ever be bothered that an anime character is being played by a white person? It's a cartoon, not a big deal. You know, whereas like Japanese people are in America are like, they live in a completely different context. So there are issues like, we're bothered that an anime character is being played by a white person because that anime character was clearly Japanese and there are already not any roles for Japanese people, you know, and that's a completely different context than Japanese people in Japan are living in.
Yeah, that has to do with like the homogeneity of a culture and how racial issues are perceived in homogeneous cultures where like in Japan, They're not historically dealing with racist oppression. If anything, they're the ones perpetrating racist oppression. Yeah. So they're like, yeah, why would I care? Like, why would I care?
Yeah.
But and it's like, very different for people who are living in the US where like anti-Asian sentiment is a very big deal.
Yeah. And it's also one of those things where it's like, even though we have discussed there are minority ethnic groups in Japan and have historically been like, Japan is largely actually very, very ethnically homogenous. So they're one of those society, like when you have a society that is either very insular or very ethnically homogenous or both, as Japan has been a lot of times, their sort of like understanding of racial or ethnic issues tends to be more like there is us and there is everyone else. You know, it's like people are like, oh, like Japanese people look at their portrayal of black people. And it's like, that's from ignorance. Like, Japanese people in Japan are like, there are Japanese people and there's everyone else in the world. You know, like, Japanese people aren't like, they don't, people in Japan don't have, like, the kind of, like, racism towards, like, black people that exists in America that comes from chattel slavery. It's a super different context, you know?
Right. And, like, even some cultural things that Americans look at, like, certain, I think it was Nordic countries, and they're like, why is it easier for them? And it's like, well, historically, a lot of those countries are very ethnically homogenous, and so when they talk about passing social programs for each other, it's kind of assumed you're all part of a broad community, whereas there are white people in the U.S. who don't want welfare programs passed because they don't want black people to benefit from them. It's like a totally different thing.
Yeah, the thing is like, yeah, the people in the Nordic countries fought really hard for their social, for their social programs and for their welfare states. They fought really hard for those things. And I'm not saying that they didn't, but they, because of being such homogenous countries, like racism is a tool of social control, and racial divides have been used in America really more than anywhere else in the world, but in lots of places that have significant racial minorities, to divide people and undermine things. Because if you can convince people that there's something fundamentally different about them and people of other ethnicities, and that the people of other ethnicities, because they are different, are bad, then you have this great tool when people all want something good to say, but if you get that good thing, those bad people might also get that good thing. And then people were like, well, I don't want the bad people to have the good thing. Only me.
And
you know, and that tool didn't really exist in Sweden in 1952, you know.
And we're seeing those chickens come home to roost now with like anti-immigrant sentiment in those places.
Yeah.
And it impacting their cultures because now they're dealing with that.
They have like a lot of really serious right wing and fascist parties in those areas that they're having to contend with. Yep.
So, yeah, I think I read it, was basically reading something about like kind of like the dark side, not dark side, but like the unspoken things about like Nordic socialist democracies that most Americans don't get because they're just like, oh, why can't we do that? And it's like their cultural context is very different. So our struggles will be very different to attain those goals.
Yeah, but also on the other hand of that, there are some people who say like, well, they're ethnically homogenous, so it was just easy for them to win those things and we'll never be able to do that. And it's like, but that's not true, you know?
And that's not what I was saying.
Oh, I know that you weren't saying that, yeah. But there are people who do.
Right, exactly. I wasn't saying it was easy. Nothing about socialism has ever been easy.
No. Yeah. Okay. So yeah, that's a little bit of a tangent, but
we're at the hour and a half mark, so
yeah.
We the Thornberrys. God, I like the animal stuff is so cool. It's just so grounded that a lot of the other elements I usually overlook in a cartoon were just really hard to overlook.
Yeah, it's like, well, it's great. Like, the animal stuff is really cool. Seeing the different places are really cool. It's like a really, really, really well-made show that's very entertaining. But just, like, watching it, like, as an adult, probably partly as an adult in 2024, I'm like, why are these children never even a little bit supervised? They need guardrails.
Yeah, as the, like, because the whole point of the podcast, right, is analyzing these things from, like, doing a retrospective as adults, and as an adult, these are the thoughts that came to mind. As a kid, I was like, wow, this is cool. And I, you know, I think kids obviously would still enjoy it today, but it's interesting how many little social things you never think about as a child, but as an adult, you're like, boy, they need so much more than they're getting.
And well, poor it's so Debbie. Interesting. Yeah, because it's like, it's so focused on this nuclear family, but yet there's so much social stuff in that little nuclear family, primarily like, why aren't there any other people? This is a problem for them. Like, the time that, like, Marianne, like, thinks something's going on with Eliza, and she's like, maybe we should move home. And Eliza's like, no. I'm like, no, Marianne, you're correct. Your daughters are teenagers. They need to be in a stable environment and around their peers.
God, so close. You're so close to making the right decision.
To making the right call. I just can't get over, like, what a dumb bitch Eliza is. I'm always like, I know, like, a lot of, like, there are a lot of kids who are like, I can do fucking anything and don't tell me what to do. But, like, every time she's like, I'm going to do this really stupid thing to just, like, prove that I can do it, I'm like, no. Like, the one episode, it's the hippo episode, where she just keeps, like, saying, like, there's no time, and just, like, rushing straight forward. And Darwin keeps telling her to wait. And he's telling her to wait because if she had literally taken 5 seconds, she would have seen that there is another option to do what she is doing that is so much easier. She did the hardest possible thing because she wouldn't just stop and wait, you know? Like, she ran up like a mountain, like she like bushwhacked up a mountain where there was a fucking trail. And the whole time Darwin's like, walking on the trail, and he's like, you doing all right there, Eliza? She's like, shut up, Darwin, there's no time to talk.
The Wild Thornberrys, where we learn a ton about animals and other peoples around the world, and where nobody ever learns any lessons ever. That's the show, folks. Like, hope you had enjoyed it.
For real, dude. I mean, like, I think I learned a Finnish adage just yesterday that I think is great and we need to immediately appropriate into the English language, is which is like trying to climb a tree ass first, which means when you do something the most difficult possible way, even though there is a much easier and more straightforward way available to you, and Eliza tries to climb every tree ass first.
Every single one, just raw. Yeah.
For sure. Yeah, she's just like, nope, all trees must be climbed ass first. And I'm like, what? Like, okay, well, okay. I mean, like, even to the extent that it's like, oh, yeah, you're going to climb a 15,000-foot mountain by yourself with literally no gear of any kind. Enjoy your, like, fucking altitude sickness that causes you to have a pleural effusion and start spitting foamy blood out of your mouth and then die. Because that's what's going to happen to you. So,
do you want that, Eliza? Huh? You're not going to be talking to any animals when you're talking with blood in your mouth.
Be fucking dead in a little ice cube. God. Frozen on top of a goddamn mountain.
So this has been the Eliza Contempt Hour. But yeah, no. Go watch it. It's still interesting, but yeah, those are
super. It's really cute and entertaining. If you have Paramount Plus or the Paramount Plus add-on on Amazon, it's all there for free. And it's a really cute show, and you learn interesting stuff about animals. Like, I would feel fine letting a kid watch that, because the stuff about how their parents should be supervising them and providing guardrails isn't going to be apparent to a child. And it's not like the show says, it's good that Eliza does all this stupid shit. Like it always causes her to nearly die, you know? So it's clear, like, no, this is dumb. Don't act this way, right?
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, let us know. Get in the comments. Let us know what you think.
Yeah, definitely. I think we were thrilled to watch it. And I think, you know, moving forward, we're trying to get on a more regular schedule with you. So we're hoping to have another show for you relatively soon. But until that time, if you would like to reach us on social media, our Facebook page is Animateys Podcast. Our Twitter account is @Animateys. And we have an email address. It's animateys@gmail.com. But the number 8 replaces the letters A and T in that. We also have a Patreon. It just kind of helps us cover the hosting fees for the podcast. And we do post occasional bonus content. There are some bonus episodes on there that have never been released to the main feed. Sometime we release episodes early there, you know, for you to get special. We don't have any tiers. You can give us $1. So if you have any interest in doing that, feel free to look us up. We're also Animateys Podcast on Patreon as well. But after all that, I have to say, as always, thank you for listening. I've been Paige.
And I've been Chris.
And this has been Animateys.